Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Eric Anderson, and today we're back with Dr. Michael Denton for part three of our discussion regarding his latest book, The Miracle of the Cell. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks, Eric. Happy to be here.
So, Mike, in our prior episodes, we've talked about fine-tuning and the remarkable properties of carbon and other key elements that facilitate life. Today, I'd like to dive right into the remarkable biochemistry at work in the cell, described in your chapter, The Double Helix.
Okay.
So I understand you went to King's College in London, where Rosalind Franklin's work on X-ray crystallography was instrumental in Watson and Crick's discovery of the double helix. And this, of course, eventually led to an appreciation that the precise arrangement of nucleotides in DNA helped specify the specific arrangement of amino acids making up a protein. Quoting from your book, many biochemists were astounded to learn that all the atoms in a complex protein could be maintained in precise spatial conformations, and that this specificity was key to enabling matter to carry out activities within the cell. What do biochemists mean by the specificity of the arrangement of atoms or molecules?
Okay, let me explain briefly. Biochemical functions depend, like the functions of our own machines, on unique three-dimensional arrangements of matter. Think of a computer or a watch. The atoms in an enzyme, for example, need to be held in a unique 3D configuration to perform a specific catalytic function. In the same way, the cogs in a watch have to be arranged in a very specific configuration if the watch is going to tell the time. So when biochemists talk of the specificity of the arrangement of atoms in a macromolecule, such as an enzyme, they are referring to the uniqueness of the 3D configuration of its constituent atoms, which is essential for the particular biochemical function the enzyme performs.
Makes sense. Okay, so this specificity of three-dimensional form is enabled by the particular bonds at work in organic chemistry. For those of us who aren't biochemists, maybe you could break it down for us in simple terms. What do you mean by strong bonds versus weak bonds?
Take strong bonds first. The strong bonds that bind the atoms together in organic compounds are covalent or electron-sharing bonds. They have an important characteristic. They are directional and impart on the molecules formed by their combining together distinct characteristic 3D molecular shapes. The other type of strong chemical bonds are termed ionic bonds. Ionic bonding occurs following the complete transfer of electrons between atoms, generating two oppositely charged ions which stick together to form the ionic bond. However, ionic bonds are not directional, and compounds formed by ionic bonds do not possess characteristic shapes. It is surely another remarkable life-giving coincidence in the nature of things that the bonds, which have just the right metastability for biochemistry, also enable the building of compounds which have their constituent atoms arranged in distinct, defined 3D configurations, which happen, as we saw above, to be an essential requirement for biochemical function.
And one of the visual images you share in the book is Robert Clark's idea of a kind of Alice in Wonderland teapot. This was absolutely fascinating. I'll certainly remember this visual image for the rest of my life. Share with us Clark's teapot analogy and what it means for our understanding of the chemistry of life.
Yeah, well, Clark provides a graphic analogy to illustrate what the consequences would be if the bonds in organic compounds were non-directional, like the ionic bonds in inorganic compounds. He asks us to imagine a teapot comprised of a spout, a lid, handle, and so forth, in which the parts continually move around the pot relative to one another. Such a strange teapot would have no defined shape and be quite unable to function as a teapot. Clark's point, if the bonds which hold together the atoms of an organic compound were non-directional and behaved like the parts of an imaginary teapot, specific functions dependent on stable, highly specific 3D arrangements of atoms would be impossible.
Yeah, I love this image. I imagine picking up the teapot by the handle and the spout slides around or the top slides around. It'd
be difficult to do biochemistry with molecules like that. Yeah.
Right.
The other type of chemical bonds that work in biological molecules are the so-called weak bonds, about 10 times weaker than the strong covalent bonds. A set of bonds which do not involve the sharing or exchange of electrons. There are three different kinds of weak bonds: electrostatic interactions, hydrogen bonds, and van der Waals interactions. But although weak, These bonds perform a critical function in the cell as they bind together the different parts of complex biopolymers like proteins and DNA into stable, defined 3D configurations upon which their biochemical functions depend.
So the different bonds then between the particles in the cell have to work together in just the right way.
Yes, and one of the most crucial aspects of their partnership is their relative strength. Because the weak bonds are so much weaker than the strong, they can be used to hold together reversibly two complex molecular surfaces, between two parts of a protein, between the two strands of the DNA, between the active site of an enzyme and its substrate. Reversibility is critical to many functions in the cell. It allows the binding and release of an enzyme from its substrate, and it allows the temporary association and dissociation of proteins in the cell, or proteins to sections of DNA. Specific reversible binding is indeed so crucial to the biochemical functions of the cell that it's no exaggeration to say that without them, the controlled chemical activities of the cell would be impossible.
Okay, so just to recap then for our listeners, we have different kinds of bonds. We've got directional bonds, non-directional bonds, strong and weak, and that's important. And then the actual strength of the bonds is also important. And when we talk about the weak bonds, you mentioned that the strength of these bonds is just right, just the way it is. Maybe another Goldilocks example?
Yes, Eric, definitely another Goldilocks example. If the weak bonds that hold the building blocks together, like we find in DNA, were much stronger, it would be extremely difficult to break apart the two strands of DNA, and replication and transcription would be practically impossible. In addition, if the weak bonds were a lot stronger than they are, the various molecules in the cell would become bound together, and the interior of the cell would essentially crystallize, becoming inert and lifeless. But on the other hand, if the weak bonds were weaker, they would be torn apart by the disruptive random collisions of particles in the cell. So the exact strength of the bonds seems to be just what's needed for proper cellular function.
Wow, yeah. So another example of fine-tuning at work.
Yeah, the specific strengths of these weak bonds are just right to confer on molecular surfaces what Jim Watson called in his Molecular Biology of the Gene, selective stickiness. I love that term. It's great because that's exactly what it is. And as he emphasizes in his words, this selective stickiness is indispensable to cellular existence. And as he also points out, the energy of the weak bonds is just right, not so large that rigid lattice arrangements develop within the cell. The interior of the cell never crystallizes as it would if the energy of the bonds were several times greater. Conversely, if they were any weaker, then the stickiness would be too weak to hold molecular surfaces together in the face of the disruptive background thermal motion of the cell. So yes, definitely another case of being just right, Goldilocks again.
Yeah, Goldilocks everywhere.
Yes, keep on getting back to Goldilocks. Okay.
So in addition to carbon, you discussed three other atoms in the periodic table, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, that seem to be key collaborators with carbon in enabling life, in part due to their differing attraction for electrons. I want to encourage readers to get the book and delve into all the remarkable details. But just at a high level, tell us the difference between hydrophobic and hydrophilic molecules and why both of these properties are essential for life. In fact, maybe I could ask you to explain one particular example from the book that jumped out at me. You mentioned a remarkable fact that many of the chemical processes on which life depends can only occur in an environment free of water. And yet our bodies are literally swimming in water, so that sounds like a tremendous contradiction. How do our cells perform this seemingly contradictory achievement of setting up water-free microenvironments inside the cell to enable these reactions to take place?
Okay. Well, first, the two terms, hydrophilic and hydrophobic. These terms come from the Greek, hydrophilic meaning water-loving and hydrophobic meaning water-fearing or hating. And they describe two fundamentally different types of organic molecule. The hydrophilic are soluble in water, while the hydrophobic are insoluble. And these differences arise from subtle differences in the affinity of the carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen atoms for electrons.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obvious why we need soluble hydrophilic compounds, as water is the matrix of life. Without soluble compounds, there could be no water-based life.
Right.
But the functioning of the cell also depends on the existence of substances which are insoluble and can form stable, insoluble barriers surrounding various intracellular compartments in the cell, and of course the cell itself. Indeed, membranes are in some ways even more important than the double helix, as without an insoluble stable barrier or membrane to surround the cell, no functioning cell would be possible, as its contents would be continually diffusing away into the environment. In essence, no hydrophobic insoluble compounds within the organic domain, there would be no stable barrier to hold the cell's constituents, and definitely no cells.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the insoluble hydrocarbon side chains of amino acids also play a vital role in protein folding and stability. And this brings me to the point you mentioned above. Their tendency to clump together to form a solid, insoluble core in the center of a protein not only promotes the folding process, but also happens to make a convenient, water-free, hydrophobic core in the center of the protein in which many chemical reactions which need to exclude water can be carried out. It's so extremely elegant.
Yeah, this is really remarkable. I think it's something that we often don't think about. These different reactions have to take place in just the right environment, and the cell finds a way to do that, even though it's, you know, swimming in water, really.
Yeah.
So there's a wonderful discussion of cell membranes in Chapter 4, and there's a lot we could cover. Membranes allow us to have different things inside the cell than the outside environment, and obviously, as you mentioned, we want the cellular components, our DNA, so forth, to be inside the cell and not floating around in the outside environment. But there's a subtler aspect to this difference between the inside and the outside environments that's absolutely essential for higher organisms like ourselves. Tell us about the concept of membrane potential and how this allows signals to be transmitted long distance through the nervous system of animals.
Okay, the membrane potential arises in all cells from the controlled flow of charged particles, primarily sodium and potassium ions, across the cell membrane. As a result, the inside of the cell becomes negatively charged with respect to the outside. The membrane potential is useful to all cells. It allows them, for example, to utilize the energy discharged when ions flow down an electric gradient to transport substances into the cell.
Okay, so in our sort of technology vernacular, the buildup of the membrane potential is kind of like charging a battery, or maybe more accurately, like charging a capacitor, which can then be quickly discharged and the energy used when needed?
Yeah. That's exactly right, yes. But in higher multicellular organisms, the membrane potential has an additional vital function in the transmission of rapid nerve signals to and from the central nervous system to the periphery, which may be a distance of several meters in large animals. Mm-hmm. The transmission of nerve signals needs to be fast if various functions are to be properly coordinated in a large animal like man. For instance, when walking, some muscles contract while at the same time others relax. It's only because of the great rapidity of nerve transmission, 100 meters per second in mammals, for example, that coordination of muscular activity is at all possible. And this comes to the question of what's behind the rapid transmission of a nerve impulse.
Mm-hmm.
The rapid transmission along a nerve cell axon is caused by a wave of depolarization of the membrane. And that's caused in turn by a sudden influx of sodium ions into the cell. Crucially, the speed the wave travels along the axon depends on the speed of depolarization of the membrane. And this in turn depends on the speed of diffusion into the cell of the sodium ions. Moreover, after depolarization, the membrane potential must be quickly reset so the nerve is ready for the next signal.
Right.
And this is the key point. The whole sophisticated design of the nervous system is entirely dependent on the very rapid diffusion rates of sodium and potassium ions. Without these highly mobile charge-carrying ions, there would be no rapid nerve transmission and no advanced nervous systems and almost certainly no advanced life forms remotely comparable to ourselves. And this is yet another case of prior fitness in nature of particular atoms for particular biological functions.
Yeah, really remarkable. So let's continue this theme of energy usage in a slightly different context, but one that uses a similar principle of membrane potential. I think most of our listeners will have heard of ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is a molecule that functions as a kind of energy currency in the cell being used for all kinds of cellular processes. One of the sources you cited in your book stated that a single cell consumes up to 10 million ATP molecules every second, just an astounding number. And I want to come back to the numbers in a minute, but first, let's focus on how ATP gets generated by the cell. How does the cell constantly produce enough ATP, 10 million of these molecules every second, to keep going?
Yeah, it's remarkable. In eukaryotic organisms like ourselves, ATP is produced primarily in the mitochondria, by a molecular machine known as ATP synthase, which is just a fancy biochemical way of saying the ATP-producing enzyme. This remarkable enzyme, which is one of the most complex enzymes known, is actually a miniature turbine embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane that spins many times per second as a result of the flow of protons across the membrane from high concentration to low concentration. A typical cell might have as many as several hundred mitochondria and up to 10,000 ATP-producing turbines in each mitochondrion. By harnessing this energy across the mitochondrial membrane, the cell is able to produce the millions of ATP molecules that are required every second.
Okay, so we have this flow of protons from inside the membrane to the outside, which ATP synthase uses to produce ATP. But pretty quickly, there won't be enough protons on the inside to keep the flow going. And now I have to say, to me, this is one of the most fascinating aspects of the book. Can you share how we get protons back into the inside of the membrane? What is the electron transport chain you talk about in the book?
Okay, yes. Firstly, ATP synthase does require a continual supply of protons, or it will quickly grind to a halt. Cells avoid this by continually pumping protons across the inner mitochondrial membrane, which then continuously flow back. And as they do, they turn the tiny turbine, and the energy discharged is utilized to synthesize ATP. It's a very remarkable and absolutely unique system. In fact, so remarkable that no one imagined that such a system empowered ATP synthesis until a few decades ago. And the researcher that first proposed the mechanism, Peter Mitchell, was eventually awarded a Nobel Prize. But for many years, no one believed him. It's been called the most counterintuitive mechanism since Darwin by Origin of Life researcher Leslie Orgel.
Yeah, it's interesting that Mitchell's proposal was initially disbelieved, not because anybody had a better explanation of what would be required from an engineering standpoint for this system to work, but because it just seems so fantastical.
It does seem fantastical, yeah. And as to the pumping itself, this occurs as electrons produced by metabolism flow down an electric gradient along what is termed an electron transport chain, which is situated in the inner mitochondrial membrane. The chain consists of a series of ion complexes. As each individual electron jumps down the energy gradient from one ion atom to the next, the small amount of energy discharged is used to pump an individual proton across the membrane. It is quite fantastical. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Yes. So we meet again in the electron transport chain and proton pumping, another example of prior fitness in nature. Why? Because it is only the iron atom and other transition metal atoms which can form electron conducting wires along which an electric gradient declines in discrete drops. So in the end, the generation of ATP, the source of all the cell's energy, depends on the unique properties of the iron atom.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I just can't stop thinking about this electron transport chain ever since I read that.
Yes, okay. It's amazing. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is. And by the way, I've got to change my accent here. I keep saying membrane, and I need to adopt a good Aussie accent and say membrane or something like that.
Well, okay. I never realized that. That's a subtle difference. Yeah, okay.
The other one you got me with the other day was capillaries, which I think is...
So how do you say that in Yankee?
Well, capillaries, we often...
Oh, yeah.
Capillaries.
Okay.
Sounds better, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So the numbers here are absolutely staggering. I mean, over a quadrillion mitochondria in the adult human body, and each of those mitochondria with thousands of ATP synthase enzymes spinning away, producing ATP, the sheer numbers are just hard to grasp.
That's right. According to biochemist Nick Lane, altogether, the proton pumps in the body pump more than 10 to the 21 of them, nearly as many as there are stars in the known universe every second. The proton pumping is only part of the story, of course. A lot more is going on in the cell as well. And definitely, yes, it's very hard to grasp the sheer numbers of reactions occurring in the cell every second. Cells are just incredibly complex objects. And perhaps the most amazing thing is not just the sheer number of controlled chemical events in the cell, but that the whole dizzying molecular dance is only possible because, as we've seen in this series of podcasts, and obviously if you read the book, because of the prior fine-tuning of the properties of individual atoms for very specific biofunctions, the core point of the miracle of the cell.
Yeah, it's truly staggering to even get a glimpse into what's going on, and it really underscores the remarkable systems in the cell and the prior fitness of the molecular and atomic parts that even make that possible. Well, it looks like that's about all the time we have for today. Would you be willing to come back again and share more about this amazing book?
Yeah, sure, of course. I'd be delighted to do that, actually, Eric. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. To find out more about the incredible fine-tuning revealed in the very atoms that make up life, as well as the remarkable systems that produce energy throughout your body every single second to enable you to pick up and read The Miracle of the Cell, get your copy today in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Until next time, I'm Eric Anderson.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.